Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Stephen Fort, Chief Strategy Officer, Chief Technology Officer, founder of multiple companies, and Executive Director, Startup Accelerator, Microsoft's Most Valuable Professional, Global Entrepreneur, and Developer. Stephen, I know you're really, really busy, so thank you for coming in today and sharing your many, many deep insights and experiences with our audience.
No problem, Stephen. It's great to be back.
Now, Stephen, you have this amazing background. You've done virtually everything out there, and you're, in fact, quite famous in many regards. So, in looking back then, what particularly useful job roles, career milestones, or valuable lessons can you share since the last time we talked?
Since the last time we spoke, I definitely have had a great experience working on the Accelerator HK project. It's a startup accelerator focused extensively on hybrid mobile development or cross-platform development. And it's been really great getting deeper and deeper into the mobile space.
Now, you talk about cross-platform or hybrid development. Are there some recommended tools that you'd sort of want to spotlight?
There are definitely a lot of tools out there. But what I tell developers is that if they're going to do cross-platform development, what they need to do is go back to good old-fashioned JavaScript. At the end of the day, that's what cross-platform development is for mobile devices. It's the ability to wrap up your JavaScript and then push it down to multiple devices. Obviously, HTML5 is equally as important. One tool I would like to call out is one called PhoneGap. It's an open source library that is under the ownership of Adobe. And PhoneGap gives you the ability to talk to native APIs on these devices, but provides an abstraction layer that you only have to write it once. So then when you're calling your API at the high level and compile it down to, let's say, iOS or Android, it's calling those APIs natively for you.
Now, for the benefit of our listeners, can you just spell that tool or platform, I should say?
PhoneGap. It is PhoneGap, and you can find it on the web at PhoneGap.
Excellent. Now, again, because of your background in the industry and you've done many, many things, in fact, especially in the development space, what kind of recommendations do you want to pass on to developers themselves? Like, what should they focus on?
I think that several things are really kind of interesting right now in the developer space. Obviously, mobile. I've been working with a mobile development startup accelerator, and that's because mobile is one of the most important things out there. But I think developers really need to look at enterprise. I think with the rush to the Facebooks and the Instagrams and all those great consumer-facing apps, we've kind of forgotten about the enterprise. And if you remember, the dot-com era was all about building these big consumer websites. But then after the dot-com era crashed, everyone started focusing on the enterprise. So I think developers in the rush to mobile did exactly the same thing. They've built out several platforms for consumers, and they're great. But I think now, the next number of years, developers will start looking at the enterprise again, both with mobility and non-mobility.
Stephen, you're a very successful serial entrepreneur, and you've worked in many, many different environments from around the world. You speak at conferences and so on. So can you share some tips about the global entrepreneurship environment?
Sure. I think there's been a bit of a renaissance in the global entrepreneurship environment, which is pretty great. More and more people are jumping in and starting businesses. And I think this is probably for two reasons. The first reason is that the cost of starting a business, and by consequence, the risk of starting a new business, has been drastically reduced over the past decade. Actually, if you look back over the last 10 plus years, it's dropped almost tenfold. And what I mean by that is the amount of money that it will cost you to get from an idea or a business plan written down in a Word document to the actual first paying customer. That's measured now in the thousands of dollars, not the hundreds of thousands of dollars, or just, 10 years ago in the millions of dollars. And that's great because that enables more and more people to jump in because less capital is required to get started. You still need a lot of money to, market it and compete with the big guns if you're going into a big red ocean, so to speak. But to actually get from your first idea to the paying customer is drastically cheaper. The second reason I think many people are jumping into startups and you see all of these people going in is that the global economy is still very weak. And what was once considered a very safe job at a bank or even a law firm is no longer considered as safe. So with a high unemployment rate, a lot of people are saying, hey, you know what? Maybe I will go join a startup. So startups have a lot more talent to go recruit from, where in the past, those people would have probably just went to a well-paying job at a bank or a law firm or something else. You're seeing more and more people that would have went into these other sectors that were hit really hard by the global recession now going into startups or starting them up themselves. And that leads to why I believe there's been so much startup education and books and new blogs and series of late, because a lot of these people are new to entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship can be taught. So I think it's been a great ecosystem that's been developing.
You know, for a big part of your career, you were based in the U.S., but I guess a few years ago, you decided to move to Hong Kong. And I'd be interested to know why you did that. And then can you describe the ecosystem or environment in Hong Kong?
Sure thing. Well, I moved to Hong Kong mostly because it was my wife's work that brought us to Hong Kong. My wife was in private equity. And again, Hong Kong, like New York, where I was based before, is a big finance town. And when I first got to Hong Kong, it was right around the time of the global economic meltdown, whatever you want to call it, you know, the Lehman Brothers. Most people were in banks, and there was not a big startup ecosystem. I would have described that the startups that were around were not really high tech, and the ones that were guys that were recently laid off from the bank. They were married to somebody local, or they just really liked Hong Kong, and they didn't want to go back to work for the bank, and they didn't want to go home. So it was mostly a handful of startups started by an expat, usually a former banker or some kind of relation to the banking industry. Luckily, that has changed, and the startup community has grown. It's a very, very passionate community. It's a big community. There's a lot of guys jumping in and doing startups, and there's a lot of great events. However, what Hong Kong lacks is an actual startup culture. Unfortunately, there's not much investment. There's actually very little investment for startups in Hong Kong. A Hong Kong startup can get investments overseas, outside of Hong Kong, but the ecosystem here for investment really tends to invest in real estate. That is the big, hot environment. Always has been. It's where most of the mainland money goes into. And being such a small, little country where we only have about 30% of the country is allowed to be built upon because the rest is either parkland or uninhabitable because it's big rugged mountains or streams and things like that. Real estate, of course, is just a big, huge opportunity. So I'm looking for the first kind of Mark Zuckerberg from Hong Kong to, you know, found a company, take it big, and then a lot of people will look at that person and say, hey, you know, we can do that here in Hong Kong too, and the investors will start coming in. And also the culture will change a little bit because the culture in Hong Kong and most of Asia is a little risk averse and thinks startup is a little bit risky. And once that starts changing, and it is changing, the Hong Kong ecosystem will grow even further.
Now, you're in Hong Kong. You're talking about the startup environment there, and, you know, you're trying to have some kind of impact within that environment. And I know you started an accelerator. Can you talk more about that, and what are your tips for forming an accelerator?
Sure. I started an accelerator back last summer, and I found a partner named Paul Orlando, which came in and was my co-founder. And what we did is we wanted to help the Hong Kong entrepreneurial environment by speeding up a certain number of teams in their process. Most people, what I mean by that is most people will work nights and weekends if they have an idea for a business. And if they go through an accelerator, they will work on it full time for 3 months and go through a program that Paul and I designed and actually speed up their process. The hope is that within the 3 months inside of an accelerator, they would accomplish 6 months to a year's worth of work that they would have done on their own or they would have done nights and weekends. And the big thing about the accelerator is we also brought some teams in from outside of Hong Kong. Hong Kong is a great environment to start a business. There's some problems, of course, is that that's skewed towards big business. So it's very, very easy to start a company in Hong Kong, but not necessarily very easy to open up a bank account. So we thought by bringing in businesses from overseas that were doing startups and talking to the government, there's a group we talk to called InvestHK, talking to the government, introducing them to these startups, that will start helping change the environment. And it slowly but surely is. And for forming an accelerator, I think probably the tips is finding mentors. We had mentors come into the teams every week, and these are people that have started businesses themselves or are investors or just people that can give these startups advice. And if you're starting an accelerator, the mentors make the program. So that would be my tip, is go out and find the best mentors you possibly can to help the teams come in each week and provide the guidance and feedback to them.
Are there other key members that should be part of an accelerator team, for example, accountants, lawyers, and technical people, and so on?
In a perfect world, and your accelerator has a good budget, what you definitely would probably want to hire first is an administrative assistant to help with all the scheduling. Our cohort was small. We started off with 16, so Paul and I were able to make sure all the meetings were scheduled and the mentor relationships were scheduled. But once you get larger than 6 or 7, you're going to need some administrative help in that regard. Also, the lawyers and the accountants are quite important. Accelerator HK was funded and ultimately owned by my parent company, Telerik. And so we used the accountants and lawyers that were on staff at Telerik to provide a lot of that, setting up the documents that were needed to make the investments in the companies. But we also hired a Hong Kong lawyer to help us with Hong Kong law in regards that most of the companies incorporated in Hong Kong. And the important thing about if you're starting an accelerator, the accountants and lawyers are only really needed at the beginning and at the end, so you probably don't want to bring them on staff. You mentioned technical team. Most accelerators, not all, but most accelerators forget about the technical side of things. And the mentors that come in just talk about customer development, and they just come in and talk about the process from a business perspective. Very few come in and talk about technical aspects. And we brought in one or two people to come in and talk about those technical aspects. So I would say having some technical folks on staff, or at least as mentors, would be quite helpful. I think the perfect accelerator would have a few developers on staff that are senior developers that can train and almost work for hire for the team during that 3-month period.
Now, Stephen, it's interesting. You mentioned customer development. So that must mean that in your training program or some of the courses or seminars or workshops you provided, you must have been following some sort of gurus out there.
That is for sure. And when it comes to customer development and the process of building a new startup from scratch, there are two gurus that everyone needs to follow. The first is named Steve Blank, and he's written a very influential book called The 4 Steps to the Epiphany. And he is a successful entrepreneur who has recently become, well, not recently, but over the last number of years, has been a professor at Stanford teaching entrepreneurship at their Entrepreneurial Thought Leaders series. And Steve Blank coined the phrase customer development, but he doesn't take credit for inventing it. He says this is the process that all successful companies have been following. And by following this process, no one's ever documented it. So he said, I'm going to go and document this, and has went and documented it. Another individual who is extremely influential and has to be followed as well is named Eric Ries. He's written a book called The Lean Startup. He was at a company that was invested in by Steve Blank. So he firsthand was using a lot of the techniques that Steve Blank wrote about in the book 4 Steps to the Epiphany. And Steve Blank also made Eric Ries audit his class at Stanford as a condition of the investment. So Eric really got a great education in the customer development methodology. And what he did is he took those concepts of customer development, and Eric Ries has a technical background like myself, and he is very familiar with the agile methodologies like XP, Scrum, and Kanban. And he was able to spin the lean startup and merge it with the agile methodologies. He was able to spin the customer development and the agile methodologies and wrote a book with that perspective called The Lean Startup. And those two individuals are the best people to follow and great advice. They have, you Google their names, they have tremendous amount of blog posts and books that you can go in and read up on.
Now, you have a startup, and I guess people are submitting business proposals, but once they're in the accelerator program that you have, do you use these business plans, or do you have some other kind of technique?
We have another technique instead of a business plan that we prefer to use, and it's been gaining a lot of traction in the global startup ecosystem. And this is called the Business Model Canvas. And the Business Model Canvas was developed in a book called Business Model Generation by someone named Alex Osterweiser. And the Business Model Canvas is a great tool that gives you the ability to look at your business very holistically in 9 different categories. Some of those categories will include your customer segments, your value proposition, your key resources, and also your partnerships, and all the types of things that you need to perform their customer development. What I mean by that is you'll hear a lot of people say, this wasn't our first idea, we pivoted, or we got to plan B. You know, we first were this idea, but now we've realized that no one wants to buy that product, and now we're going to do a different idea. And what's great is the Business Model Canvas gives you the ability to map all of this out. And then when you go out and start talking to your potential customers and you start giving them prototypes to work with, which we call an MVP or minimum viable product, once you give someone a prototype to play with and they give you some positive or negative feedback, you go back and you might change your business model canvas. And what I mean by that is you may have decided that the segment you were targeting was a video game for high school girls. And then after giving them the game to play with your minimum viable product or your prototype, you realize that it probably applies more towards a different segment. Maybe older girls, maybe college age girls, or girls in their, ladies in their 20s. So then you would change your segment from saying, we are focusing on younger women to focusing on older women. And that's what you would call a pivot, or that's a change in your philosophy, a change in something on your business model. Canvas has changed, and that's the pivot. And that affects all the other things on your business model canvas. If you change your segment, it changes your pricing. High school girls don't have credit cards. Older women do have credit cards. So it changes your whole philosophy about the business. So the business model canvas is tied very closely with the customer development process and the lean startup process as well.
Now, Stephen, you mentioned that you did accept a cohort and they went into your accelerator HK program. How many of them pivoted?
I would say that every one of them pivoted in a small capacity, and probably 5 out of the 6 pivoted in a major capacity. And one team came to Hong Kong with an idea about location-based services and left Hong Kong doing a social media marketing campaign. So completely changed what they were doing. And that was done by the process of showing people a prototype, going out on the street, talking to people, buying people coffee in Starbucks, and asking them what they think about their process, and asking them what they think about their potential product, and then getting that feedback. And they came to us, and I think they were very nervous, and they said, we don't think our original idea has any legs to it. We want to start thinking of something new. And they actually spent about 2 weeks brainstorming, and sometimes 3, 4, 5 times a day, going outside and talking to people, and then coming back, redoing their business model canvas, making a new prototype, and doing this over and over again, and eventually settling on a much better idea.
Now, we talked about some of the tips for forming an accelerator. What are your best practices for operating an accelerator?
Operating an accelerator is a pretty interesting endeavor, and I think the number one issue that we had was space. It took us a while to find space for an accelerator. The problem is, if you're only doing accelerator twice a year and you're using it for, let's say, 3 months to 14 weeks, it's very difficult to find those types of short-term leases. So we made a partnership with a co-work space in Hong Kong for our first cohort, and that worked out fairly well for us, except that that co-work space started gaining new members, and we were a large group. So for our second cohort, we're going to go try a different co-work space in Hong Kong, which is a little bigger and may provide a slightly better partnership than the first one. In addition to that, I think the other avenues of operating a cohort are your regularly scheduled meetings. So as I mentioned before, administration is key. And I went and interviewed a lot of other people that have went through accelerators in the past, and they complained that the meetings were sporadic, or that, you know, things were scheduled and people didn't show up. So we made our meetings the same time every week. We had one-on-one meetings with the teams. We had regular check-ins with the teams. So each team at the same time every week was expected to do, you know, certain meetings. There's probably, each team probably had 4 or 5 hours of meetings every single week between the mentors, between Paul and myself, or the group check-in. So we just tried to do those always at the exact same time. So it's much easier to schedule, and using things like Google Calendar. We also used a chat room, an online chat room that was on the mobile phone called WeChat. It's made by Tencent, which is a Chinese company based in Shenzhen. It's similar to WhatsApp, or it's similar to Line, if you've ever used those. And if you're not familiar with any of those, it's basically IM for the phone. And we were able to coordinate and schedule several things using our WeChat chat room. That was, everyone joined the chat room, so we're able to blast out information that way. So operating the cohort really is a logistical process once it gets started. Before it gets started, there's a lot of legal and accounting things that need to take place. But I'll be honest, I left that part to the lawyer. Since I don't have a legal degree, I did not want to offer my opinion on any of that kind of stuff.
Now, for the benefit of the audience, maybe they don't even know what an accelerator is and how much, like, what's the trade-off? What do these startup people have to give up for you to provide space for them? Do the teams come in and live off this site and then come into the shared workspace during the day? And what happens after they finish the acceleration process? Where do they go? There's all these other kinds of questions.
You're absolutely right. There's a lot of process that goes into that. And what happens is we put out an application for the accelerator a few months in advance. Teams apply. Teams, when I say teams, they're usually 2 people with an idea. And we prefer people coming into the accelerator with at least 1 business person and 1 technical person. and we make an investment in their company. The investment is usually the same. It's about $15,000 US. And we take, depending on the stage that the company is in, but we prefer super early stage. So we take 8% of the company for that $15,000. It sounds like a lot, but once I'm done explaining, you'll realize that it's probably just about right. So then when that $15,000 is used to come to Hong Kong if you're from outside Hong Kong, and it's used for you to help find some housing and all that. And so they live off that money. They come into Hong Kong and they come to the co-work space every day. We do expect the teams to come and work at the co-work space every day. So it is a full-time program. It's not possible to be a full-time student or work full-time and participate in the program. You really would need to have everyone come to Hong Kong and participate in the program. So they work at the co-work space every day. And it's, you know, it's based in Hong Kong right by the train system. So you can go to pretty much any part of Hong Kong to do your, you know, customer interviews and go outside and talk to people. And the program runs for 14 weeks. During that 14-week program, we provide two things in addition to the co-working space. We provide some guidership and mentorship from Paul Orlando and myself, which includes some education on the things I mentioned before. So if you come to Hong Kong not understanding the business model canvas, not understanding customer development or the concepts of the lean startup, all of that would be explained to you during almost like a teacher-student environment for the first couple of weeks. And then we also provide the mentorship that comes in every week from outside the accelerator that gives you a different perspective than Paul and myself. And we have one-on-ones with them and check-ins. And then at the end of the program, we have what's called Demo Day. And at Demo Day, after the 14 weeks are over, the teams will make a 7 or 8 minute presentation in a room full of people, you know, 200 people or so. And that's usually filled with everyone from the local startup ecosystem. So there's investors, there's reporters, there's other startups, there's just interested parties. We had a whole random amount of people. We had a lot of people from the government who came that were very interested in what we're doing. I mentioned InvestHK before. We had people from that government agency, and we had people from the incubator programs and science parks and all of that. And they make about a 7 or 8 minute presentation on their progress. And then at the end of demo day, so that takes about an hour, we have booths set up. And at each booth, they have the ability then to give people a demo of their app or talk further, especially if a reporter or an investor comes by. And being Hong Kong, there's a lot of social and network aspects in Hong Kong and every one of these events. So we bought the refreshments. We bought beer and juice and tea and some snacks, and we put them with the teams. So in order to get a beer or a soda, you had to go and actually talk to one of the teams, which was a pretty good idea to force everyone to go mingle. And we had different beverages and snacks at different tables, and each of the teams brought a snack or a drink from their home country. Like, we had a team from Mexico, so they brought some tequila. So it forced the people to go, if they wanted to try different drinks or try different snacks, they were forced to go talk to teams, even if they were not necessarily all that interested in that team. So it really forced a lot of networking. And that's what the end of the program is. And when the program is over, it's actually not completely over. We still check in with the teams every 30 days with a Skype call, Paul and myself. And we'll pretty much continue doing that until they don't need it anymore. And we also are providing some marketing assistance because we did a lot of recordings and interviews, and we're starting to push those out right now on social media. Now that it's been about 7 or 8 weeks since demo day, we're pushing out on YouTube and things like that. Interviews we've done with the team, some promotional videos we shot, and their demo day presentations themselves. So that in a nutshell is what the accelerator looks like. Other accelerators operate slightly differently. Sometimes some accelerators, such as Y Combinator, do not provide space and don't have much of a formal structure. They rely on the teams themselves to set up office hours. And but I think most of the small accelerators operate the same way we do.
So let's get more into the selection of the cohort themselves. You talked a little bit about that, but, you know, what were you looking for? You know, what are some of the sort of the attributes that you think will make for success? And you already talked about, you know, the pivoting process, but is there any other details you can add?
Well, selecting a cohort was very difficult. This was the very first time Accelerator HK was running, so it was a brand new accelerator, so we had to get the word out. And we only have the applications open for 3 or 4 weeks. So people are, it's like applying to a university you've never heard of, but yet we still had almost 100 applications for the 6 slots. I think it was over 80 applications for the 6 slots that we took. And as I told you before, the number one thing that we looked at was the makeup of the team. I think the people are more important than anything else. So we looked at the background of the founders. We looked at how long they knew each other. We asked them that very question on the application, like, how long do you guys know each other? Like, did you find yourselves randomly, or were you introduced? Have you worked together before? And one of the teams that we took, all the teams that we took, most of the founders have known each other for a decent period of time. And one of the teams that we took, we were not even all that convinced with the idea. We liked the space the idea was in. We weren't necessarily convinced that the idea was perfect. And so that kind of leads to the second point. So the first is the team itself. The second is the idea. And if you have a great team, and if they have a great idea, well, that's easy. You have a great team with a good idea, but in a really hot, interesting segment or category, like mobile and location-based, or, you know, things like that, or connected peer-to-peer gaming, right? So these are hot spaces. Maybe if their idea isn't perfect, we figure that that's what the program is for, right? If you have a great team, that they're coachable and that they are adaptable and that they are, you know, worked well together or look like they work well together, and they come with a good idea or a great idea in a really hot market, those are the attributes that we're really looking for. And lastly, we're also hoping and looking for teams that are coachable, because the process is, as you mentioned before, as I talked about, being a pivot, and we don't want someone to come that's really married to the idea and are not willing to pivot. We're not going to force you to pivot. The market will force you to pivot, but we are going to force you to go out and talk to potential customers. So when we narrowed down our short list and we started interviewing people over Skype or in person if you're based in Hong Kong, we wanted to make sure that they weren't 100% steadfast, going to roll forward with their idea. We wanted to make sure that they were coachable and had the ability to go out and potentially pivot. And this led us to reject some really solid companies. And I told them when I rejected them, we're not rejecting you because we don't believe in your team or your company. We're rejecting you because you're too far along. You actually have hired PhDs. Like, one company was that we rejected had a couple PhDs in that category. They were not going to pivot into something completely different. They were going to definitely stay in that, in what they've done. They've had some patents and IP around what they're doing. And I said, if you have patents and PhDs, you are way further along. Because most guys that come into the accelerator, the teams that we accept, haven't even written any code yet. They've just really maybe have a small prototype and a business model canvas. That's actually the perfect team.
Hey, Stephen, I'm interested in that group that had PhDs and patents. Maybe you should forward that along.
Well, certainly will.
Now, you already talked about your demo day, and you talked about the whole accelerator operational process, the strategy behind it, the customer development, the lean startup, the business canvas idea, all great sort of foundations for making this thing work. Now, what do you want to accomplish in the long term?
In the long term, I would like to help the entrepreneurial environment, both here in Hong Kong and globally. As I said in one of my previous answers to your questions, is I feel that there are a lot of people jumping into entrepreneurship that are being drawn to entrepreneurship for one of several reasons, you know, either the low cost or the global economic environment. And these are people that would not normally be an entrepreneur. These are people that have been drawn to entrepreneurship because of the changing environment. And these people need education. They're not your natural person that would always jump into an entrepreneurship environment. So long term, I hope to change the model a little bit, where I think your early round of investment will be provided more by accelerators, and that comes with the educational component, and that's something that sticks with you forever. And I hope to help grow that accelerator ecosystem around the world by being, you know, one of the standout startup accelerators.
Have you actually looked at tech stores at all?
I have looked at every single accelerator out there. Well, I can't look at every single because there's so many of them now. But a year ago when I was setting up Accelerate HK, I looked at TechStars, and I like TechStars because they provide the only one that I know of that provides some technical guidance. So I stole a little bit of that from them, or borrowed a little bit of that from their model. Of course, I looked at Y Combinator, and I borrowed their model of the investments. And I also looked at two other accelerators that I happened to mentor at. So I got to be friendly and know their founders and their teams as well. And they actually guided me and mentored me when I was starting this process. It's called China Accelerator. And then the same group, it's SOS Ventures, the same group also runs Hackcelerator. China Accelerator is very similar to Accelerator HK. Focuses on teams that have some kind of slant with the Chinese market, and it's based up in Dalian in China, and it runs now it runs twice a year, but it used to be a summer program. And Hackcelerator is a very unique accelerator, as I said, run by the same group of people at SOS Ventures. And Hackcelerator is a hardware accelerator, based up in Shenzhen, of course, where all the factories are and the supply chain component markets. And Hackcelerator is great because Hackcelerator has everyone solving the same problem, meaning they're all in the same domain. They're all in the domain of hardware. It's the only accelerator of its type that has that kind of laser beam focus. And that's what gave me the idea for Accelerate HK to focus on mobile and then get even a little bit more narrow and focus on cross-platform mobile or hybrid development.
So how will accelerators change the entrepreneurial ecosystem?
Well, accelerators are very easy to set up, and they don't cost a lot of money beyond the investment and the lawyer. So if you already have that ecosystem built, if you're an angel investor or a group of angel investors or a corporate venture arm or just a corporation that wants to start an accelerator, it's very easy to set up. The hardest part, as I told you before, is attracting the right mentors. If you attract good mentors, you're going to attract a great cohort because your mentors will also help you promote your cohort. And I actually think that we're going to have a lot more accelerators out there. So I think that what happens is the accelerators will start replacing the friends and family realm that you'll see in a lot of startups, and they'll just start naturally saying, hey, we're two guys with an idea, and we're going to just, you know, we're going to fund this by applying to accelerators. And they may get rejected from one or two. And instead of taking out loans and, you know, maxing out their credit cards, they're just going to wait until an accelerator accepts them. And what I find interesting about that is I think that's actually a good thing. Some people say, oh, you know, there's going to be a bubble of accelerators. I don't believe there's a bubble, because bubbles imply that an asset is being being inflated for, you know, not because of its market value, but because of hype. And accelerators are formed with their own money, not investors' money, and they're not an asset. So they're not inflating anything. And in addition, accelerators are making, you know, all these investments in these small companies. They're not inflating their value either. They're giving them very, very, very tiny amount of money, only enough for them to survive. And in that 3-month period that you go through an accelerator, the business is either going to live or it's going to die. And usually about a third of the companies don't even make it out of the accelerator or die very shortly after they get out of an accelerator. So I think that accelerators will long term increase the amount of innovation in society, because they will spread out and make so many investments in all these early stage companies. And a lot of them will fail, but a lot of them will also succeed.
So what do you hope the survival rate will be sort of in 5 years post-acceleration in your accelerator? Do you want 50% of the companies, or 10%, 20%? What do you think you're targeting?
To be honest, I want them all to succeed, right? It's hard not to when you take in a cohort and you work with these people every day for 3 months. You want all of them to go out and be successful, build mature companies. You want them all to live that entrepreneurial dream. If their goal is one day to be acquired or have a big IPO, I wish that for all of them. Realistically, the statistics say the following, that about 1/3 do well upon graduation, 1/3 kind of struggle along and maybe don't make it and don't get funding, and 1/3 never make it out of the accelerator. And that's a pretty consistent statistic. I've seen other cohorts. We were lucky. All of our teams graduated, and actually some of them are starting to thrive right now. So hopefully we'll beat the odds in our first go. But I assume that over time our averages will balance out to the accelerator average. So I would say that the 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, again, the first third, the top third, go out, get funding, make it big. Well, not necessarily make it big, but go out, get funding and do something with their business. Another third, get out of the program, but don't get any funding, struggle along. And then another third, don't even make it out of the program. I would think that those numbers seem right to me. That seems about right. And I wouldn't want to necessarily change that number. But as I said in the previous answer, I would like to change the number of accelerators. I would love to see the number of accelerators worldwide double. So then, as I said, we're just, instead of creating, let's just say accelerators today, incubate 1,000 companies. So only a third of those are getting funded. That'd be 300 companies. I would love to see that number double or triple over the next couple of years. And the only way you'll do that is have more and more accelerators.
Well, Steve, we're going to pivot in this interview now. And we're going to just ask some sort of more broader questions. And this first one is about, you know, what do you see as the really truly disruptive technology forces over the next 5 years, and why are you making these forces your choices?
Well, I think the two things that are going to change drastically over the next 5 years or so are processing power and ultimately energy storage or specifically battery life. And these are being driven, well, I'll tell you why in a second, but I think the changes that these will bring will be staggering. I think processing power can be on an order of anywhere between, 50 to 100 times more powerful than it is today. So imagine your mobile phone that is, 100 times more processing power. And you might be thinking, oh, so I can play Angry Birds, that much more powerful. But it's not necessarily the Angry Birds. Yeah, you can have really great, even better HD graphics in your video games and things like that. But your phone will be able to do things that you can't even imagine. Just think about things like Google Now and Siri. And think about how the phone is a digital hub in your life. You carry it around and do everything with it. And think of the same with your tablets. And you'll be able to do things with speech recognition and, sorting big data really, really fast in ways unimaginable today. And that will just open up opportunities that that just frankly don't exist today. And the same type of thing happened with software as well in the PC era. And processing power started doubling every 18 months. And if you look at a PC in the 80s and you look at it just maybe 10, 15 years later when processing power was up, 10, 20x, the types of applications you're able to do was staggering. We try to augment this by outsourcing some of these functions to the cloud. For example, Siri cannot process, if people are not familiar with Siri by now, if they haven't seen Apple's marketing, Siri and Google Now are allow you to speak into the phone and ask it questions, and theoretically you'll get the correct answer back, or you say, hey Siri, hey Google Now, set my alarm for 7 a.m., or get me Steve Ibracki's phone number, and it'll try to do that, or say, who is the president of the United States, or list the last 5 prime ministers of Canada, things like that. And what Siri does today and Google Now does today is the phones are not powerful enough to process that information, so they send it out to the cloud to process it on those big servers in the cloud and then send the result back. Ultimately, that is quirky, and then, of course, it doesn't work in an offline environment. So I can't, if I am traveling and I don't have 3G or Wi-Fi, I can't say, call my wife. I just can't do it, which is staggering, right, that you would think a phone should be able to do that with today's processing power. So that's an example of how we try to get around this limit today, and it doesn't work well. So we will be able to open up a tremendous amount of applications. Battery life, I think, is self-explanatory. It will help keep devices on for days and days or even weeks. I actually think probably in about 5 years' time, your smartphone will be, as I said, 100 times more powerful, but you're going to have a 2 to 3 week battery life. And that will actually enable us to use the phone a little differently. Today, with the phone barely lasting a day, the battery life starts to affect how we use the applications, especially on the iPhone, where you can't remove the battery. You actually start turning off push notifications, turning off all your GPS-enabled applications in order to preserve the battery life. So the horrible battery lives of the phones today are affecting your behavior and how you actually interact with your phone. And this is not, of course, just for the phone. It's for all devices. And when I say devices, you're probably thinking of tablets, but start thinking of wearable devices. Start thinking of things in the future like Google Glass or these smartwatches that are rumored to be coming out as well, and all the other things that the companies are imagining that we can't even imagine today. And the reason why I choose these as kind of the disruptive two technologies, so I think I explained why I think they're disruptive, but because they open up just a wealth of applications that just didn't exist today. But the reason why I think that they're my choices is I think that things are pushing us in the direction. The research being done for quantum computing will help us with the processing power, and the research that comes out of that will affect today's kind of transistor-based processors. But quantum mechanics and quantum processing will even take that further. So 15 years from now, we might have 1,000x processor speeds, which sounds unfathomable, but it's definitely coming on the horizon.
Now, you're working in the software development area. You're also an entrepreneur, and you've done a lot of executive management and so on. But your background is not in computing, and yet you are a working software engineer and have been for many, many years. So this kind of begs the question, we have computing and we have other professions like accounting, medicine, and law. So should computing be a recognized profession on par with those other professions, with things like demonstrated professional development, adherence to a code of ethics, personal responsibility, public accountability, some level of quality assurance and recognized credentials like those other professions?
This has definitely been a topic that I've been thinking about and honestly have went back and forth on over the years. I definitely feel that there should be something. So There's been a movement over the years about this topic. I've been following it, since the turn of the millennia. I've been following it since the late 90s. A gentleman named Steve McConnell produced a straw man for what this would look like and even wrote a book about it. I believe it was called After the Gold Rush. I'm not sure if the book is still in print. And he talks very specifically about exactly what you said. He said, programming software development should be a recognized profession. And part of that recognized profession would be just like becoming a doctor or a lawyer, where you would have a set curriculum in school and university, and you would have a recognized degree with a recognized certification, so to speak, the way that doctors are licensed and lawyers are licensed. And I used to think this was a great idea, and I do think that parts of this are still a great idea, but I'm against the concept of maybe a license. I don't think you need a license to be a software developer. I think it's still a skill. It's still skills and traits, and so many people want to become developers or maybe just code small things in their spare time. They don't necessarily need the formal training you would get in a university. That said, the concept of the career track, a recognized public accountability, a code of ethics, a personal code of ethics, career ladders, levels, I actually think are quite important. And I do think that some kind of standardization body will start working on that. You already see this, let's say, in the project management field, where you start seeing things like you have a recognized project management professional accreditation and certifications and things like that. I think there should be almost like a tier-based system. If you are going to be working on life-critical, mission-critical applications, I do think that there should be some type of recognizable accreditation or certification that you're going to be working on. And I think if you're, senior developers working on software worth millions and millions of dollars, you should definitely have obtained these accreditations and certifications. That said, if you're working at a small company as a developer, or you're working at a small company as a systems engineer, or let's say a startup as a coder at a startup, I don't think you necessarily need a very high level of accreditation. You just need the credentials, insofar as you just need the experience. Just as we're not asking the marketing people to go out and get an accreditation in marketing, we just hope that they come to the job with experience. I think the same thing with software development in these non-critical environments. I would like to see that everyone who enters the industry adhere towards a public code of ethics, where these accreditation bodies that would accredit the very senior people that are going and working for NASA and working on medical devices and working, in the government, like a developer for the FBI working on very critical applications, as I said, should have these accreditations. I would like to see that all developers, even the guys who are just learning JavaScript on the weekends and coding their daughter's soccer team's website, I would actually like to see that hobbyist developer still sign a code of ethics. And I think that's something that could be done starting with the community, and it could be self-enforced, that everyone is going to want to sign these code of ethics. And lastly, I feel that because when you become a doctor and you become a lawyer, it's pretty easy to certify and accredit those professions. Meaning is, you go to law school, there's curriculums for it, and then you take an exam, the bar exam, and the bar is based upon United States law and then the legal system of the state you're taking the exam in. And it's similar in other countries. Here in Hong Kong, you take an exam based on Hong Kong law after you've went through your law school. And in order to practice law in Hong Kong, you need to be certified under the Hong Kong, Legal Association. So all you need to do is learn Hong Kong law and then all the other, the code of ethics, take your exam and you're a lawyer. Same thing for a doctor. Treating cancer is treating cancer. Treating, the flu is treating the flu. In software, you have rapidly changing different technology. It's impossible to accredit someone and then 3 months later that accreditation will be invalid because technology is moving so fast. I mean, if you credit someone today in some of the hot popular languages like JavaScript or Java itself or C# or Ruby on Rails, in 2 or 3 years from now those languages will either have changed drastically or been replaced with other languages. So when it comes to that, I think we can rely on the professional certifications to augment the profession itself.
Steve, we're down to our last two questions, and this next one is not technology related at all. It's about, you're this recognized global expert, you're a serial entrepreneur, extremely successful, and so you travel a lot, you speak a lot, you've seen a lot of things. Are there any stories you want to share?
Well, I could share lots of stories, but in the interest of time, I'll keep it to a handful. And one of them was just a few weeks ago, and this is an interesting one. You mentioned that I speak a lot, and I probably speak at anywhere between 5 and 10 conferences a year internationally. And I was speaking up in mainland China at this event, and while I was speaking, an earthquake happened. And this was a first for me. As I said, I speak at, 10-plus events a year, do 2 or 3 sessions. I've been speaking for 15 years. I've done the math. I mean, I've probably spoken at, 300-400 events. And what's interesting is I've had the power go out. I've had France win the World Cup while I was speaking in France. I've had some really interesting things go on in my career. But I've never had an earthquake while I was speaking. So that was fun. I just kept going. I didn't know what to do. It wasn't a massive earthquake. You felt the earthquake, but I felt that it was a, I felt that since there was no building damage, there was no, it wasn't like an earthquake that was going to cause major structural damage. It just shook things around, maybe knocked a few things over. And that was a fun one. Another one is last summer I was in Sydney, Australia, and I was judging a student software competition. It kind of reminded me a little bit of the Accelerator because I had to judge all these student projects, and I had to judge them based on what they've done. And they worked for an entire semester, or actually the entire school year. And it was sponsored by Microsoft, and Microsoft gives them a theme, and they give them kind of some surface area. What I mean by that is the theme that they were given was, I think this year's theme was helping people in that respect. So they weren't, but it had to be commercially viable. And the surface area, what I mean by that is it had to be a mobile app. So they were told, some years they're told, e-commerce, some years they're told different things. And what was amazing is I'd say about 160 countries were represented, when the process started. Probably about the same came, so one team from each country is chosen. So the way it works is students at a university, it's all done at university. So student at a university will compete to represent the university. And then those representatives of the university will compete in their region and then eventually compete to represent their country. And then the one that represents the country is selected into the finals, and then they all come to the final. And it's always held in a city somewhere around the world. And this year it was held, and last year it was held in Sydney, Australia. So the software contest, and this is the part that really kind of rocked my world, so to speak, is the software contest had 6 finalists when it was all finally narrowed down. And of the 6 finalists, they had 5 of them, now that I think about it, 5 of them had a hardware component. They went out and built their own hardware to augment their software solution. So this was a software competition. And what I realized is that hardware is really kind of as easy and cheap to put together and work with, just as easy as software is. And, as recently as 5 years ago, they would not have been able to do this because it was just too expensive. The hardware wasn't componentized. The hardware wasn't, mass produced in the way that it is today. And you can thank the iPhone, which started the smartphone and tablet revolution that's gone on in the last 5 or 6 years. The supply chains now are formed, and you can get screens for, touch screens to put into your application that, or put into your hardware solution. You can get it for a fraction of the cost of what it would have been 4 or 5 years ago. 4 or 5 years ago, it had to have been custom made. And every time we get a new popular phone or a new popular device or other gadget, it brings the price of everything else down. So an accelerometer probably costs about 30 or 40 cents. A Wi-Fi radio, the same. All these components are less than a dollar. And even if you don't buy them in bulk, they're still very, very inexpensive. And I really never thought about it until I saw that competition down in Sydney, Australia. So I thought that was probably one of the most worthwhile things I've ever done. I give up a lot of my time to judge competitions, speak at some of these events, or judge at a pitch night. And every now and again, you get something really amazing in return. And this was one of those cases. And I'll share one quick story as well. Is your readers and your listeners might remember from our previous conversation that I do all this charity work in Nepal. So I'm still doing that. I'm still going to Nepal every year on a charity trek where it raises money for schools. And I just wanted to highlight this year because I brought my 65-year-old father with me. And I got him to climb up to just over 6,000 meters or 18,000 feet, with a group of, I think there are about 10 of us this year. So it was a great experience, and I just like always mentioning that at the in these interviews, because it's a great way to give back. I get away from the computers, I get away from the startups, I get away from the mobile phones for 2 or 3 weeks when I'm trekking in the mountains.
Okay, now we're down to our last question, and this is where I turn the tables, and I'm saying, if you were conducting this interview, what questions would you have asked? Then what would be your answers?
So if I was looking at my profile and I was conducting the interview, I would probably, my first question would be similar to one of the ones you asked, but very specifically saying, what's the best advice that you would give to people applying to an accelerator? And the reason why I would ask that question is because there are so many accelerators out there and so many people are looking for good advice. And my answer would be very similar to what I was talking about with you before, is focus on your team and the category that you're in and the product that you're developing, and demonstrate that you have the ability to be coached and potentially pivot. And I think that that's the big advice that I would give most of the team. The other one I would ask, just looking at my background being involved in the startup ecosystem in Hong Kong, is, you know, if a city that one of your listeners lives in has no startup community, has no startup ecosystem, but if there's no startup community, what should that person do? And my answer to that would be, start it yourself. Go to meetup.com and start a meetup for your city, and become a community leader, and very quickly other people will come and help you. It's very easy to just get people together that are, you know, kind of have the same problem, to talk about those problems. So that would definitely be the advice that I would give people. And I think on the non-technical side, since seeing a lot of my bio, I do talk about those trips to Nepal. I would ask, why Nepal? Why not India? Why not Brazil? Why not, you know, some other place? And it's a real simple answer is when on my very first trip to Nepal, the place really touched me. I went into a village, and my Sherpas are the local people, and my Sherpa, who was helping us climb the mountain, when we rolled into a village, he went and worked in the fields for a couple hours after a long day of hiking. And I said, hey, is this your village? And he said, no, this is not my village. And I wanted to meet his family. And I said, well, then why are you working in the field? Like, do you know anyone in this village? He goes, no, I know nobody in this village. And I said, why are you working in the field? And he goes, well, I know that in my village, there are Sherpas walking through my village today, and they will help my wife in the fields. And I don't even know who those Sherpas are. And that just touched me, the sense of community. And I just would like to, every time I go to Nepal, I try to bring a little bit of that community back with me and spread it out into the world. And, so that's pretty much the three questions I would ask myself.
Yeah, I love that Sherpa story. So I think maybe next time, maybe somebody will catch you working in the fields too.
It's very possible. They do put us to work now. I've been there so many times. I'm considered one of the family.
Well, Stephen, I really enjoyed this time with you, and you shared so many insights, but I know you're really, really busy, and yet you took the time to talk with me, and I really appreciate you coming in today and sharing your experiences with our audience.
No problem. It was my pleasure to share them.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Stephen Fort, Chief Strategy Officer, Chief Technology Officer, founder of multiple companies, and executive director of a startup accelerator Hong Kong, a Microsoft Most Valuable Professional, a global entrepreneur and developer.